From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we explain the dark store loophole, which some businesses are utilizing to decrease their property tax burden.
They can be significant because obviously these properties, whether it's a manufacturing plant or a large retail store, they can have significant amounts of property tax.
Wisconsin writer Marsha Bjornrud explains the concept of timefulness and how she believes it can help save the earth.
And the director of Skylight Theater's new production of Five Guys Named Mo makes the case for coming to see it.
We're asking the audience to just come along for the ride. You're going to cry. You're going to laugh. We're going to make you get up, get on stage. We're going to make you dance. We're going to make you sing. All of those things. And so it's like you have to dive in. And when you dive in, it's like you're building community.
Lake Effect is next, after the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Earlier this month, the city of Wauwatosa was featured in a New York Times article. But instead of the flyover country narratives we've become used to here in Wisconsin, the piece focused on a new tax avoidance tactic that has some municipalities worried. It's called the dark store loophole, and it's become a popular tool for businesses looking to decrease their tax burden in the Badger State.
Jason Stein is director of research at the Wisconsin Policy Forum, which has been researching the impact of this tax avoidance tactic. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and starts by explaining the mechanics of the dark store loophole.
Well, this all comes back to how businesses are assessed for billing for property tax purposes. And so so-called dark store challenges are appeals that retailers or other businesses are making in which they're arguing that their assessments, their property tax assessments, should take into account the values of similar properties that are now vacant or dark, and that's how you get that term.
Now, what is the argument for that? Because I think anyone looking at that, really on the face of it, they go, well, one store has been vacant for quite a while, and the other one is doing business every day. Why would we assess them in the same way?
Sure. The argument on the part of the retailers, and to be clear, our organization hasn't taken a position on this one way or the other. We're a nonpartisan organization. But to explain the argument of the retailers, they are arguing that in the marketplace, the real estate marketplace, if you have some stores that are vacant, that is an indication of what the value of such a property would be. If it didn't have a tenant in it, a viable tenant in it, and that should be at least in part factored in when a municipality goes to assess the value of a piece of property for the purposes of levying the property tax.
Okay. How is the value of a property generally determined?
Well, there's three main approaches in Wisconsin. There is the sales approach, which looks at what buyers have paid for other comparable properties. There is the cost approach, which focuses on how much does it cost to build a property minus any depreciation that would have happened in the intervening years. And then there is the income approach that looks at how much income does a property generate. So, for example, an apartment building with high rents would be assessed more under that approach than a building with very low rents.
So I think this kind of gets to the heart of who is making these appeals. What are the businesses who are generally making these appeals in the state of Wisconsin? Because it does seem pretty unique to big box stores.
Certainly big box retailers are one of the groups that have made a significant use of this type of appeal. But it is not strictly limited to big box retailers. So you have seen some use of it, for example, something comparable done by manufacturers. manufacturers also happen to be one class of property that is assessed by the state government rather than by local city or other municipal governments. And again, they have made a similar argument in which they say, well, you should be factoring in how much this factory would fetch on the market if it were vacant. And obviously the argument on the other side, which I haven't given until now, is no, a store that is vacant, a factory that is vacant, is not comparable, the advocates on the other side say, to a store that is filled and doing a brisk business, or a factory that is filled and churning out widgets and making a profit on a daily basis.
Yeah, so the argument on one side is essentially these are specialized stores. They aren't going to get maybe the best price on the market, in part because they would have to be changed so drastically. But yes, the other side of the argument is that, well, it's not a vacant property. So that, this is kind of a hypothetical.
Right. Right. I think that's a fair summary of the debate and the controversy.
So this was actually featured recently in the New York Times. It highlighted specifically Wauwatosa. And it seems like they used kind of Wauwatosa as a way of talking about the issue more deeply. But what is happening in places like Wauwatosa, like these other Wisconsin towns that have a lot of big box stores, have a lot of that kind of industry, who might be making these appeals?
Sure. Well, again, for a corporation, if they see that some competitors or other people within the groups within the marketplace are making this argument, then you know they're going to consider it because they have a responsibility to shareholders. And so if they see an opportunity to increase their margins or lower their taxes, they're obviously going to look at it. As far as you know what's happening in the marketplace, I think you know, part of what we're discussing here is obviously we live in a global marketplace. We have seen the rise of internet retailers over in recent years. And obviously there are dislocations in the market, there are changes. And so, you know, one question is, I think that underlays this whole debate is what will be happening with brick and mortar retailers in future years. And, you know, that may be in part both the concern on the part of municipal governments, as well as perhaps some of the urgency on the part of traditional retailers who want to be as competitive as possible.
Yeah. But what does it mean for taxpayers in a given municipality? I mean, you mentioned, of course, manufacturers. A lot of that goes into the state of Wisconsin as opposed to a city or county. But when it comes to municipalities who are taking in these tax dollars, what does it mean when their taxes are decreased pretty significantly in some cases?
Right. That I'm glad you asked that question because that's a part of this that we hadn't talked about. Obviously, they're still, in the greater scheme of things, a relatively small number of dark store appeals, but they can be significant because obviously these properties, whether it's a manufacturing plant or a large retail store, they can have significant amounts of property tax. If they successfully appeal and get their property tax assessment and their property tax bill lowered, then the municipality has got to decide, do they just simply forego those revenues with a potential impact on services, or do they spread those lost taxes onto other property owners in the same jurisdiction? And so what you can potentially have is a situation where the taxes on a retail store go down, and then they go up on homeowners and other businesses in that same city or that same jurisdiction.
I mean, one of the things that the New York Times piece pointed out was just how significant the increase to individual homeowners, individual taxpayers, can be, as much as, you know, $300 in one case of increased taxes as a result of a manufacturer, I believe, in that case, making this appeal, getting their taxes lowered. How much are we seeing these kinds of tax challenges around the state of Wisconsin, and what kind of impact is it already having on taxpayers?
Sure. So I can speak to that. It's really going to vary on a community-by-community basis, right? So if you had a modest-sized retailer in a large city like, say, Milwaukee or Madison, and they successfully appeal and get their assessment lowered, you know, the individual impact on a given home or other business may not be noticeable, right? I mean, it may be a relatively minimal impact. On the other hand, if you have a small community, and let's say they have an anchor manufacturing plant, and that anchor manufacturing plant gets its assessment lowered by a significant amount, okay, in that situation, yes, you could have, you know, a $50 increase on a home, or even an increase into the hundreds of dollars on a home. And so it's really on a case-by-case basis. And part of the, you know, what it comes down to is how big is that business when it's compared to the overall property tax base in that community? And it's just going to vary.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I know this is an issue that lawmakers have been at least talking about. How are they addressing the issue? Is there any pending legislation on these kinds of dark store loopholes, as they're often referred to?
Sure. Well, there's a Legislative Council Study Committee that looked at the issue. They made some recommendations related to property tax assessments. I have not looked at those recommendations in any depth. Some of the people involved in the debate have argued that those recommendations would not significantly alter the kinds of disputes or issues that we've just talked about. I think clearly there were strong efforts both to change and to preserve the status quo in the past legislative session. None of that is going to go away. You're going to see a debate over this issue, a very vigorous debate over this issue in the next legislative session that has just begun. And we're going to have to see what the outcome of that is. Obviously, Republican legislative leaders have been reluctant to make changes. Governor Evers and some lawmakers of both parties have argued for making changes. And we're just going to have to see how that all plays out.
Jason Stein is the Director of Research at the Wisconsin Policy Forum, a nonpartisan organization that analyzes policies in Wisconsin. Stein spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. You can find a link to some of the forum's research on the dark store loophole at WUWM.com.
We will take a quick break now, and then a Wisconsin writer makes the case for understanding geologic time as a way to help save the Earth. This is Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
We are back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Understanding the enormous timescales in our planet's long history can be difficult, practically mind-boggling.
But Wisconsin writer Marcia Bjornrud hopes her new book makes that history accessible to more people, and at the same time helps us grasp the magnitude of our effects on the planet.
Bjornrud talked with Lake Effect's Susan Bentz about the book, starting with the significance of its title, Timefulness.
So timefulness is a deliberate counterpoint to timelessness. We kind of have this idea that we like things to be unchanging forever and somehow hovering above us in a way that is eternal. But the fact is, everything is full of time, and the recognition of that can actually be something that helps us make peace with our own short time on the planet, but also understand our deep roots here as well. So geologists have this habit. We look out on the landscape and see the many different iterations that it records.
I'd love to start with that idea of looking out at the landscape, and one you share early in the book is a snow day in the 1970s.
Right. So I think anyone who's grown up in a snowy climate has had that wonderful experience of waking up to a bright white world and then learning that the normal mundane schedules have been suspended and all of a sudden the day is yours. So I start with that, and a deep memory that I have of looking at our old world atlas when people didn't use Google Maps all the time and happening upon a page that showed all the time zones around the world, which generally run longitudinally. But there were a couple of places on this map that said no official time, so areas that were colored gray. And one of those was a remote archipelago in Arctic Norway called Svalbard. And I was just fascinated by this idea of this remote place that somehow had been exempt from time, measurements of time. As it happened, I actually ended up doing my PhD research in geology in Svalbard, and many years later found that it was not this romantic idea where time was running free, but in fact, a political disagreement between the Norwegians and the Russians, whether to use Moscow time or Oslo time there. But in a sense, the place was kind of exempted from time in being a bit of the ice age that was still with us, at least in the early 1980s and 90s when I was working there. More recently, when I've gone back, I've sadly found that time has come back with a vengeance to that place, and the ice age has lost its grip, and in fact, the place is changing faster than almost anywhere else in the world. So I use that old memory of a snowy day in Wisconsin as a starting point for my journey as a geologist and my relationship with time, both as a person and as a scientist.
Was it a certain something that motivated you to write this book?
Well, I think it's a growing sense of frustration with leadership and a growing sense of desperation as a scientist who sees how quickly human changes are affecting the Earth system and trying to cast it in a new, fresh way, making a human argument for thinking scientifically about Earth processes. I think as geologists, ironically, we're partly to blame. For years and years, geology has been trying to inculcate people with the idea that the Earth is old and geologic processes are slow. And now we're trying to change the narrative to say, well, actually, the Earth can change really fast, and we're changing it. And I think part of the difficulty in getting people to take climate change seriously is that we've changed the narrative a little bit. Both of these things are actually true. The Earth is old, and in the main, geologic processes are slow. But on the other hand, sometimes things can change fast. And we are now, we as humans are now numerous enough that we are agents of the first order. So the book is an attempt to recast some things that maybe people have heard before in a more human framework and argue that a scientific understanding of the Earth is imperative for us as a species, but it's also something that can be a source of some kind of existential solace as individuals.
So, Marcia, give an example of that recasting.
Well, a good part of the book is just kind of exposing the rates of different processes. So I talk about, in Bob Dylan's song, Blowing in the Wind, Bob Dylan asks the question, how many years can a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? Which is actually a rather profound geological question. And so in that chapter, I talk about rates of tectonic processes, of earthquakes, of erosion. And the point is that there are many overlapping rates. Again, some are underlying slow rates. The tectonic plates move at rates of inches per year, about as fast as our fingernails grow, so slowly, but not so slowly that it's beyond our perception. And then other times, of course, they lurch. They can move hundreds of feet in a fraction of a second in a large earthquake. So the Earth has many modes and tempos, some of which are so fast that we can't react. We think of the Earth as something that's kind of static, and we are the ones that are fast, but sometimes the roles are reversed, and we don't like it when the Earth does these sudden lurches. And the same goes for the climate. And sometimes climate change is really a slow process, but it can be accelerated at rates that become very uncomfortable for us.
So one of the elements, I mean, you pack a lot of information into really not very many pages. It's just exquisitely crafted, I think. One element is a simplified geologic timescale. It's amazing just to have these points of reference.
Yeah, and Wisconsin has a remarkable record of a big part of the geologic timescale. Of course, no one place, not even the Grand Canyon, has a record of all of geologic time. That the timescale has been put together over the last two centuries by thousands and thousands of geologists from all over the world, and little by little we've pieced together this global story of the whole planet. But I think often people don't realize that here in Wisconsin we have a remarkably long record of many parts of that long story, especially the old rocks in the northern third of Wisconsin record mountain belts that came and went, a great rifting event, sort of like what's going on in East Africa today, a hot spot interval where we would have been something like Yellowstone. So we have a remarkable record of a good chunk of Earth's long history in our backyards.
I am a person who appreciates landscapes and who places value on our resources. But you, as a scientist, a geologist, see landscapes differently than many of us.
I think that's true. And for me, it's something that it's like learning to read. Once you learn to read, you can't not read again. It's a habit of mind. It's a habit of seeing. An analogy that I sometimes use is that of palimpsest texts. This is a word that's used by medievalists, medieval scholars, to describe ancient parchments that were inked, written on with ink, but then because parchment was expensive and difficult to make, they were reused, so the ink was scraped off, and then they were inked over again with new writings. But always there'd be some vestige of the earlier writing remaining beneath the more recent writing. And I think that's a great metaphor for the way geologists see landscapes. We can look out and see what it looks like today, but we can also see vestiges of these earlier versions of the landscape. And of course, they may become faint at some point, but you have this sense that time is still with us, that the place has this long backstory. Another way I sometimes describe geologic thinking is to say it's the etymology of the world. It explains how things came to be. I've always loved word origins that give us this kind of insight into how the vocabulary that we use today actually has these deep roots in the past. And I think geology is that for every place on the earth that we can look at.
There's the natural world and how we impact it, and then the regulations that our governments craft, presumably to safeguard those systems.
Right, to safeguard the systems, and I would argue ourselves. So the systems are robust. They've been around a long time. We can do damage to them. But in the end, nature will do what nature does. And especially with respect to the climate system, we think we're much more resilient than we really are. Earth has seen hotter times and it's seen colder times, and ecosystems have come and gone with those climate changes of the past. But humans get really upset with the smallest little perturbations. A hurricane can come through, and we think it's the biggest catastrophe that we've ever seen. And we're not quite as robust as we would like to think we are. So I think, although I certainly believe nature should be protected in its own right, it may frankly be a more compelling argument, and it's also an accurate one, that we need to take care of nature so that nature will take care of us. Otherwise, we're going to see rapid changes that will cost us a lot economically, socially, cause political unrest, and that's part of the message of the book, that we're tinkering with nature in ways that are dangerous to ourselves.
Your own awakening began as a young person. You're a scientist. You're immersed in the deep history of our Earth. And now we have ever-heightened concerns about, are we going to survive? Mm-hmm. Do you find that tempering your work with students?
I think it does. I think when I started teaching especially as a woman in the sciences, I was always very careful to not show much of myself, maybe, in my teaching. And I've realized as a teacher and also as someone who speaks in public venues quite a bit, that that's probably wrong. As scientists, many of us feel very passionate relationships with the things that we study. As we get to know the natural world better, we develop, something almost like love for the things that we study because we know them intimately. And I think it's okay to show that very human side of the sciences. Science is a very human endeavor. Understanding things in depth is, something that humans alone, we think, do in looking at the natural world. So I have slowly become more comfortable with talking about how science has informed my own personal worldview, both in my writing and in my teaching.
Could you talk a bit about what you see as the danger of time blindness?
Well, the fact is time passes. So we need to plan. We need to understand both human time scales and then the natural time scales that are commensurate with human activities. So my call for thinking like a geologist is really not that radical. I'm asking for us to learn to be able to think on decadal, maybe century kinds of timescales. That's the kind of timescale over which we can make government policy, we can have corporations acting on those timescales, and those are the ones that are going to be relevant for climate change that's looming over us.
As I see it, you're calling for a redemocratization, our view or our planning for the future.
That's right. Right now, the future is being left. No one is taking care of future generations. We don't really have that as a priority. And so the default is a future that we're leaving to our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, where there are going to be compounding problems in natural systems that will then aggravate underlying tensions in political and economic systems. And that's just irresponsible. Many people who are maybe would identify as political conservatives say we have an obligation not to leave debt to our those who follow us. So I would argue what we're doing to the climate system is leaving a very deep natural debt to coming generations. And that's something we should take seriously. We need to build into our political and economic systems mechanisms and incentives for longer-term thinking rather than short-term rewards, whether they're economic gains or political power. Most of the reward systems reward short-term thinkers.
So where do individual earthlings, how do we move on this?
Yeah, so I think we can take actions at different levels. As individuals, I maybe naively believe that a shift in our perception of who we are and learning more about the natural world, wherever you are, learning the names of plants and mushrooms and soil types, that's you as an individual, every day we can learn better about the natural environment in which we live, and it leads to a humility, I think, and an awareness that there are things that vastly predate us. We are not in charge of everything. So I think that's a starting point. Obviously, as an educator, I believe in the power of education. So we can fund better science in our schools. I would love to see earth science more represented in our public schools. And as voters and citizens, we can make sure that we're electing officials who have some understanding of natural systems and how human economies interact with those systems. So I think there are many levels at which we can act.
So think and act like a geologist?
I guess so. I'm not very objective, but that's a start anyway.
Marcia Bjornrud is professor of geology at Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin. Her new book is called Timefulness: How Thinking Like a Geologist Can Help Save the World. She talked about it with Lake Effect's Susan Bentz.
Next on the show, a chat with the creative team behind Five Guys Named Mo, opening this weekend at the Skylight. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke.
Gonna tell you a story from way back. Truck on down and dig me jack. Let's be go.
When Five Guys Named Mo opened in London in 1990, it gave audiences a chance to hear or reacquaint themselves with the music of Louis Jordan. Jordan's music was a mix of blues, jazz, boogie-woogie, and even rock and roll. He was famous in his lifetime for songs such as Is You Is or Is You Ain't My Baby and G.I. Jive, and earned the nickname the King of the Jukebox. As an African-American, he was successful in crossing over and reaching white audiences at a time that was relatively rare.
What is still rare is to find a theatrical production of any kind whose creative team is led entirely by women. But that is the case in Skylight Music Theater's production of Five Guys Named Mo, which opens this Friday at the Broadway Theater Center. Christy Childs Twilley is the music director, Lynette Costas is the choreographer, and Malkia Stampley is the director. I joined them at the end of a recent rehearsal, and I asked what perspective a female creative team brings to this production.
Well, the men are talking about the women, so why don't you get the help from the women, you know? And that's really, to me, it's always funny when you hear guys giving other guys straight men advice about women, when it's like, why don't you talk to your mom or your sister? And so I feel like in a way we are that. We're their sisters. We represent who they're talking about. And I think that we're just another eye too. And at the end of the day, we're all colleagues and we're all friends and we're all artists and we all want a great product, a great project that we can bring to Milwaukee and to the audience. And I think that we're accomplishing it pretty well.
Do you find, Lynette, that the guys resist in any way taking direction from you or taking choreography from you?
No, not at all. Actually, I think in the beginning they resisted. We decided to input a set dance warm-up for them, which a lot of them are not used to. They're not used to moving their bodies every day and having to warm up their bodies, and it's a dance-heavy show. So we wanted to make sure that we had it in our daily schedule, that they rehearsed and had a warm-up. And for them, at first, I think they were reluctant, not that I was running it, but that it was something new for them and a new experience. But once they got used to it, they really were open. And even with the choreography, they've been really open to asking questions and me directing them. They've been really, I think, open to all of us.
Yes, absolutely true. Yes.
I imagine they're all used to dealing, because they're musical theater actors, so they're used to that. But are you having any interesting interactions with them musically?
Absolutely, because I think that they all know what their voices sound like, and they're very confident about what they like about their voices. But I'm asking them to consider things like timbre and color and probably deeper levels of sensitivity in their singing than maybe they're used to. And that's not only when they're singing their solos, it's when they're working as a group.
Maybe even particularly because they really have to be tight in that harmony when they're working together.
Absolutely. And I think that them being able to see our reaction as women in the room to what they're doing is also having them adjust in ways that they wouldn't have before. It's like they're under a hypercritical eye.
And these are, I mean, the cast that we have and even the staff that we've been working with are our friends. And they are my favorite Milwaukee actors and Chicago actors, and Gavin Lawrence, who's playing Nomax, who the story is centered around. He's like a brother to me. And so these are people who've been cheerleaders for me in my career. And so coming into the room, there's been a few times where one of them would nudge me and say, you better make sure you speak up. Or when they saw that maybe that I was holding back for whatever reason, they would be the ones pushing me to make sure that I wasn't afraid to lead them. They always say, we want your vision to come to life. We want to make sure we're helping this be your story. And that, to have that support, and that's why I feel like they're brothers in the room, and that it's such a great energy in this room. And I think it's partially because they know that this is rare. This is very rare in Milwaukee and in theater, and it's a special time, and it's a special opportunity for Skylight and for Milwaukee to look at itself and say, if you don't see this on a daily basis or a few times throughout the year, then maybe you should consider this. And I think that these guys and all the men in the building are excited to be a part of that and excited to support that as well.
So you mentioned the vision for the show. What is your vision for the show? Because the music is delicious. We already know that.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. Louis Jordan. I'm new to Louis Jordan as of a year ago. I heard of Let the Good Times Roll, As You Is or As You Ain't, My Baby. But his repertoire, my goodness, that rock and roll or the swing, the jump blues, all of that and kind of mixed into one. I wanted to honor that era. I wanted to honor him and men of that time. You had men, whether you were going to the store or to the club or to the church, all wearing suits. Yes, that style, I wanted to honor that. And I also, there's just something about seeing six men on stage singing these tight harmonies, in particular black men, having an African-American husband, my father, my brother. I think of all the black men that I know, and being able to honor them. And so each of our six men are uniquely different. They're all different, and so I wanted to highlight each of their personalities as well. And these five guys, Nemo, they're this band, they're this group. They're like guardian angels in a way. And they come and help Nomax, who's having woman problems. He's having some issues, and he also needs to face some deeper demons in his life. And so they turn that mirror on him. And so in doing that, I like to think of our five guys as the highest evolution of men. Men who are men, who have gone through some things, who have experienced it, but who are now coming back to show this young man, hey, I've done that. Hey, I've been there. And because of that, now you need to fix this. Louis Jordan's so witty. His lyrics, oh my goodness. And some of it is quite raunchy.
Yes, well, that was part of that time, and certainly from the blues. I mean, you go back into the 20s and you listen to Bessie Smith, and it wasn't exactly chaste.
Yeah, absolutely. It was like the outward expression of what you probably shouldn't say, but because you're adding music to it, somehow it now becomes socially acceptable for me to say these things I never would.
Right. Well, you know, you talk about the men in their suits, and there is something. There are so many wonderful photographs from the 30s and the 40s and the 50s of African American men. I'm thinking of the ones in New York, and I can't think of the photographer, but
Gordon
that
Parks.
I think so. Yes, I think so. Where these wonderful photographs of men in these. I mean, you could slice a steak on the crease in those trousers, and everything was sharp, and everything looked good, and people took pride.
Yes.
In that. And there's, it's not that we don't take pride now, it's just different. It's just a different time. And there's something about that time that I just love men dressed that way.
Yes, and even thinking about the jive talkers and the hustlers on the street, they spoke with clarity. It's always interesting to hear those groups, whether they're talking or performing. There was a level of what we would call today being proper. There was a level of a pride that. Not that we don't have pride today, but there's almost this rebellion against dressing what we consider to be nice or wearing, some people call them, monkey suits or whatever, but there is something to that. There was this pride in making sure that we always represented our best selves. And you didn't only look nice on Sunday. You looked nice when you got home, because during the day you're working as a maid, or you're working as a janitor, or you're cleaning the streets, or whatever that is. And so you whenever you could dress nice, that's when you did.
When I arrived, you were just finishing up rehearsal, and I was hearing some really wonderful stride piano and a walk and bass going on that. And so for you, did you have to do any research into the kinds of music, the kind of playing that was happening at that time?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I did when we first started this process was I sort of came up with a sheet of recordings and videos that I that I wanted the musicians and the orchestra to listen to, as well as the actors, because I really wanted to stay true to the period, not what jazz is now, but what that sound was at that time, what Louis Jordan's Timpani 5 sounded like. So as far as the piano playing aspect comes from it, you know, I come from a musical family. My dad's a professional jazz musician, my uncles, my godfather. And I actually, when I was growing up, I used to listen to all of this old music with my grandfather. So I already had a really good vibe for what it was just from being around it. But then just comes the challenge of now embracing that rhythmically constantly in your left hand, because even the bassist, I mean, his line is pretty straight. But meanwhile, I have to be the constant boogie-woogie blues. I have to be the train. So I have to embody the character of all of these different things. And even the Moes at some point, and the ways that they're singing, the rhythm of my left hand is a reflection of their
parts. It's almost like you're the sixth Mo.
Yeah.
Yes. Is that fair?
Oh, it absolutely is. And when we first started, Ray and I, the artistic director of Skylight, when we first talked about this, we knew that the music director, the conductor, would be another character. And so meeting Christy, it was like, yes, yes. It was wonderful because, one, she's a girl, so girl power. And then knowing that she will be the single female representation on stage rocking it out on the piano. I always love the piano. It's my most favorite instrument. And so we have a special spotlight on her too, just so those certain moments we can make sure we feature her awesome sound.
So is there something bigger that you want people to take away from this?
Oh my gosh. There's always something bigger, I guess. For me, I want people to realize outside of the story that there are some amazing artists of color in our city and in our country who are great beyond the label of our culture identity, but just because we are great and we are out here and we deserve to work just as much and we are just as good. And so I'm proud to showcase that. We have African-American female light designer. I honestly had never met in my entire life an African-American female professional light designer until our designer run through. We had been chatting through email and on the phone. Never in my life. And that's
a shame. It's 2019.
It's 2019. Yes, right. Mm-hmm. It's 2019. So my mind has been blown, even with me knowing a lot of artists of color and fighting for that and being an advocate for it. So that's the bigger hope. But coming into the theater, I really want our audience to go away having just a good time. And you can say that about any show, but this show, it's a roller coaster story, and it's so heartfelt. Gavin Lawrence, I mentioned him earlier, he's a core company member at APT, phenomenal actor. He really brings the heart of this story out, and you go on this emotional roller coaster. And so we're asking the audience to just come along for the ride. You're gonna cry, you're gonna laugh, we're gonna make you get up, get on stage. We're gonna make you dance, we're gonna make you sing, all of those things. And so it's like you have to dive in. And when you dive in, it's like you're building community, you're building family, and that's so important, especially considering Skylight's audience, the traditional Skylight audience, and they don't look like the people on stage, not all the time, not when I was growing up coming here. And so knowing that that interaction is going to happen, and knowing the new audience members that are going to be coming, and those who have been coming that do look like us, and everyone doing the conga line together, those kinds
or singing the songs if you happen to know them,
or singing those songs. Yeah. So it's a party. It's a really good. It's a great party. And so I want them to enjoy the show and dive in.
Yeah, and I also hope that this won't be the last time that I get to talk to a female creative team.
Yes.
That this shouldn't be something that's unusual. This should just be like, hey, let's just go talk to the director, the music director, and the choreographer.
I have no doubt about that. It will not be the last time. Like, we've looked at each other and was like, we're gonna do this again.
Yeah. There's just something so special. Like, I started off as a classical pianist, and so, you know, usually I'm used to being the only one in the room, the only one in the group, a woman of color, and everybody thinks you probably don't do whatever your skill is. And so to walk into this team and this production meeting, it was like so easy to breathe. Just with the entire Skylight staff, they were so amazing and wonderful and welcoming. But then to just have all of these women on the production team, it's like, wow, there are no barriers here. There's this like unrealized tension that's normally there. It just isn't present. And it's phenomenal.
That's interesting, because to think you only notice it when it's not there and you go, oh, my shoulders aren't up around my ears.
Yeah,
or whatever it is. My stomach
isn't moving.
Yeah, something. And, you know, and that's a wonderful thing. It's almost like you don't have to prove you deserve a place at the table.
Yes, right? Exactly.
Yeah. That was something we talked about before. Like Makia was saying, the cast has been really open and encouraging with us. And I think we've discussed it for the three of us that often you come in the room and you feel like before anyone gets to know you, you have to prove your worth and why you're at the front of the room or why you're leading this rehearsal or leading this music. You have to often prove yourself first, and we didn't feel that when we came in. We had each other. We were able to support each other. But everybody was so welcoming that we didn't feel that we had to prove ourselves. They just took us for what we were and really were engaging and really open arms. They were with open arms with all of us. I think it was really good.
Well, it can't have happened soon enough, really, when you think about it. It's a long time coming. And so it is wonderful to sit across the table from the three of you. And I'm just so looking forward to seeing it. And I want to thank you for taking some time to talk with us.
Thank you, Bonnie. We appreciate your support.
Absolutely.
Malkia Stampley is the director of Skylight Music Theater's production of Five Guys Named Mo. Lynette Costas is choreographer. And Christy Childs Twilley is the music director. The show opens tomorrow night at the Broadway Theater Center in the Third Ward. And there is more at WUWM.com.
We'll take one more break and then some more creativity, a fresh poem for the fresh snowfall, and some music from a Milwaukee singer-songwriter whose new album comes out tomorrow. That comes along when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We have time for a poem on today's show, and a timely one at that, thanks to an unscheduled snow day for Lake Effect contributor Ed Minkowski.
Tuesday, I was driving back from West Bend, and I was behind a snowplow driver, and just looking at how intricate and specific their movements were on Highway 45. So I pulled off on the Richfield exit and typed this poem up into my phone once I was at a safe spot in a parked location. It's called Ode to the Plow Drivers. Driving behind a plow truck, watching the driver choose their line, which blades to scour the cement, the angle, the height. Like being handed a pickaxe, instructed to execute precise surgical maneuvers while avoiding invisible snow-covered banana peels, concrete aisles, and that one car parked in the middle of the block. I wonder if they ever think of themselves as sculptors of a grand scale. I hope so. I hope so. I hope so.
Milwaukee poet and Lake Effect contributor Ed Minkowski reading his poem Ode to the Plow Drivers. We should mention that Ed is one of dozens of poets who will read from their work at Woodland Pattern's 25th Annual Poetry Marathon. It runs this weekend at the shop in River West. Ed will be on stage during the midnight to 1 a.m. shift if you happen to be a night owl.
Finally today, from one former Lake Effect intern to another, Trapper Shep has been back in his old office numerous times since his last tour of duty with Lake Effect. The Milwaukee-based singer-songwriter is embarking on a tour this weekend in support of his new album, Primetime Illusion, which officially comes out tomorrow. We will feature a full interview with him next week, but here is a song from the new album, which he performed in Studio C1. It's called Shakedown.
I've seen the northern light, the prettiest sights high in the atmosphere, and I've earned my stripes, learned how to fight. Now I've got nothing to fear, and the sun's spitting rocks. I'm flying a night hawk, faster than the speed of sound. Way down below, everything seems slow, and I never wanna touch down. Shake down, we're going steady. Shake down, people get ready. Shake down, we're going steady now. Yes, I learned how to walk, then I learned how to talk, then I looked up to the sky. No more trial runs, rehearsals are done. It is time to fly. Shake down, we're going steady. Shake down, people get ready. Shake down, we're going steady now. Shake down, we're going steady. Shake down, people get ready. Shake down, we're going steady now. Ba-ba-ba, 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 ba-ba-ba. Yes, I'll know where I'm at, won't be lost in combat. I'll be coming home when I touch down and the wheels hit the ground.
Trapper Shep with his brother Tanner Shep and Shakedown. It's from Trapper's new album, Primetime Illusion, and it was recorded in Lake Effects Performance Studio. The album comes out tomorrow, and Trapper plays at the Collectivo Back Room next Saturday night. We will have a full interview with him on Lake Effect next week. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It is 11 o'clock.
Shake down, we're going steady.